Hello and welcome to the Do One Better podcast in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Alberto Ligi from London. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not already doing so, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Today, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome onto the show Kate Grant, Chief Executive of the Fistula Foundation. The Fistula Foundation is a global leader in fistula treatment. They help women suffering with obstetric fistula by providing more surgeries than any other organization, including the U.S. government and including the United Nations. Last year, in 2023, they received a $15 million gift from philanthropist McKinsey Scott. So today we're going to be looking at the work they do and also how that $15 million has impacted them and what that looked like, both in terms of securing that gift, accounting for that gift, and planning strategically for it as well. It's timely that we're going live with this episode today, the 8th of April, 2024, since yesterday was World Health Day. So without further ado, Kate, a big heartfelt welcome onto the Do One Better podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't we start by finding out a little bit about the Fistula Foundation? You're the chief executive. Would love to find out what the organization's all about.
Sure. Well, first, let's just get to some definitions. Fistula is a generic medical term that basically means a hole between an internal organ and the outside world. And the kind of fistula that we worry about is obstetric fistula. Obstetric, obviously, having to do with childbirth. This is a childbirth injury. It was eradicated in developed parts of the world, like the United States and Europe, 100 plus years ago, with C-section deliveries mainly. But in developing countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in the poor corners of Asia, where women don't have access to emergency obstetric care too often, it's an injury that basically happens when labor goes on for too long, and a woman develops injuries, and the injuries are basically holes that produce incontinence. So what we focus on, and there's about a million women that have this incontinence that's been, again, the result of unrelieved obstructed labor. What the Fistula Foundation does is focus on treating those million women. And the treatment is surgery. 80 to 90% of the time, it's successful. And it takes a woman from not just incontinent, but too often a position of being socially outcast because of that incontinence. Most of the time, these are young women living in rural parts of, again, countries in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. So that's what we do. We do more of these surgeries than even fund more of these surgeries than even the U.S. government or the U.N. We work in over 25 countries.
What countries are you in without labeling all of them?
But our biggest program is in Kenya, which is a country of roughly 50 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. We've got, I think, 9 hospital partners, although I could check that, that do surgeries. We've been there for a decade and do a couple thousand surgeries just in Kenya alone. So that's one of the larger sort of countries we work in terms of impact and number of surgeries. We also work in other big countries like Nigeria, which has a population of over 200 million. And then we work in smaller countries like Zambia, for instance, Angola, Mozambique. In Asia, we only work in 4 countries. Luckily, most of Asia is economically more prosperous than sub-Saharan Africa. And fistula really is a condition of poverty, and the fact that poverty affects women and girls often worse than it affects men and boys. As Bill Gates once said, poverty is sexist. And to a certain degree, fistula, a childbirth injury, is a result of not having enough resources directed to women when they're at their most vulnerable, which is delivering children. In fact, if you want to know the day in a woman's life she's statistically most likely to die, it's the day she delivers a child in sub-Saharan Africa. If she's in sub-Saharan Africa, she delivers a child. So that's about resource allocation and lack of it. And to a certain degree, again, fistula is a symptom of a bigger problem. But we focus on treating the million women that have this problem, because the surgery truly transforms their life. I know that sounds, people talk about kale smoothies or something transforming their life, but this really does that. I've seen it and been in this position for almost 20 years and traveled to multiple countries and met amazing women, amazing doctors that do this work. And it really does take a woman from, again, too often being a social outcast in her community, and delivers her something that's priceless truly, which is a hopeful and healthy future.
Yeah. And how do you operate as a foundation? So you mentioned some of the hospitals that are partners of yours. Are you mainly a grant maker, or you're an operating foundation? Tell me a little bit about how you go about driving.
I use a metaphor because I think at least it works for me, is that the Fistula Foundation is basically a bridge. On one side of that bridge are these women that I've been talking about that are injured for no fault of their own. They've been trying to deliver a baby. Most of the time that child also has died. So they deliver a stillborn child and they wake up incontinent, and that is decimating. So it's those women and then the doctors that are trained to treat them that are on one side of the bridge. The other side of the bridge are people with resources that can help, resources mostly in the form of money. And that's why most of our donors, majority are in the United States. We have donors in more than 70 countries, but most of those countries are, OECD countries and prosperous countries in Asia and other parts of the world. But so the bridge basically takes the money that's on one side of it in prosperous countries and delivers it to doctors. So the mechanism for that are grant agreements. We have contractual agreements with all of those hospitals in the form of a grant. But we also strive to create true partnerships with those hospitals. So most of our partners we've had stay with us. I joke that we're a little bit like Warren Buffett of vaginas. In other words, we develop a partnership and we stick with it. Our longest term partner outside of the original partner in Ethiopia is Denny Mukwege in Congo, runs Panzi Hospital, a name that may be familiar to some. He won the Nobel Peace Prize several years ago for his courageous work there. But we started funding him in 2009. We still fund his work. Same with our first four partners that year, and on it goes. And those partnerships are based on a deep abiding respect, as well as I would say common sense humility, that says folks that are running a hospital know more about what is going to be needed there than us. So we try to be very conscious of the fact that money distorts power. We have money, and so that gives us power in a relationship, but we want to cede most of that because the people that have the knowledge are not us. I mean, we have some knowledge, of course, but they have the knowledge that's important to their local environment. So back to what we do, we basically raise money. It goes over this bridge that's been sort of constructed over time to have, I would say, a fiduciary integrity. And then we work with our partners, a growing network of them, to deliver surgeries.
Yeah. And in terms of the scale, you touched a little bit, your work in Kenya and the surgeries that you do there. So tell me a little bit about it. And you referenced NGOs to some extent and the UN. And how do you try to get up to where you need to get up?
Well, I would say here's sort of some scale points that are both sort of good and bad. The first year we were at this, 2009, and I say use 9 as the sort of kickoff year. The foundation was actually founded in 2000, but for the first 8 years, we were focused only on supporting one hospital in Ethiopia. That's the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, now named Hamlet Fistula Hospital. And it was the pioneering hospital founded by a husband and wife team, Catherine and Reg Hamlin, who it's now named for. And we were really a support organization. In 2009, we started working in 2008, but officially and very early in 2009, kicked off a global mission. But we sort of used that as our beginning date because that's when we really sort of changed our mission pretty dramatically. And that first year, I think we funded something like 500 surgeries. This last year, we funded 14,000 surgeries. So there's a quite satisfying trajectory of growth. And this year, 2024, we'll fund our 100,000th surgery. Okay, that's great. Except when you know that there are a million women. Now, one thing I would add as a footnote for any public health experts, that million comes out of meta-analysis. In other words, there's not great population level data. And that's because this is an injury that happens mostly to women that live in remote parts or tend to be remote parts of rural Africa in general and rural Asia. And so the data is not as solid as we like, but a million is a number that the field has agreed upon. So we have a long way to go still, even though we've come a long way from that 500 to that 14,000. We have a long way to go to ensure that women don't suffer needlessly. Because the thing about this that gets me out of bed every day is the surgery, most of the time, takes less than an hour. And it can just transform a life. And the idea that a woman, if any of us were sitting, you know, incontinent, and this is not even a normal incontinence, because alert here about a body parts that sometimes are stigmatized, those bodily wastes come out of a woman's vagina. So it's a horrible, miserable, stigmatizing condition. But the great news is, with a trained surgeon, often that can be fixed in an hour. And so the idea of being that one input providing extraordinary outcomes is deeply motivating. And I think it's honestly what keeps and gets our donors that have been so amazing to help us fund this work. It gets them engaged, that they know that they're helping is something that truly is going to transform somebody's life.
And there's so many foundations out there focusing on that, on gender, Sustainable Development Goal 5, making sure that women and girls, you know, they experience life to the full. This must resonate with that segment of foundations and donors, mustn't it?
It does. I would say it's a good question. I would say with individual donors in particular, I think it resonates deeply. We hear often, I can't believe that this is still happening in a modern world. Why is it that in the United States, which has a notoriously weak healthcare system, healthcare industry more than a system, you can show up in a hospital here as being undocumented. And if you're in obstructed labor, you'll get a C-section. Now, somebody might be hounding your family forever to pay for it, but you'll get that. And that's just not true in a lot of places in sub-Saharan Africa. So the idea that one woman would have to go through labor for days without having access to emergency obstetric care is horrible. But the idea that then she would suffer for decades because of lack of a service that we all take for granted, I do think that that's deeply motivating to individuals. It's honestly been harder, and this is frustrating to me, to get support from larger foundations. Why? We have the results. We have peer-reviewed data. We have all the results approve what I said we do at scale and with efficiency. But we're treating it's sort of a downstream problem. And I hate when it's referred to that way. It's like women are just like, I don't know, fish in a stream or, you know, but it's the problem that we treat has already happened. That woman is already injured. And we're fixing an injury. The bigger foundations tend to fund, again, I hate this terminology, but it's common, is upstream. In other words, what can we do to prevent problems? I mean, and some of that funding is extraordinary. I mean, the work that the Gates Foundation's done with Gavi, the vaccine initiative to inoculate hundreds of millions of kids, they've saved God knows how many lives. So it's not that I don't see the benefit in funding things upstream at scale to prevent problems. I do. Where I'm somewhat frustrated with the larger foundations is it's been almost uniformly difficult to get them to support us. What we tend to get is, you guys are doing amazing work. We so respect what you do, except we fund things that are trying to prevent problems more than trying to fix an existing problem. I mean, it's not entirely true, but it's mostly true. The outlier in that would be Mackenzie Scott, who, if my son hadn't already been born and named, I would name him Mackenzie, because I think she's, I wish more philanthropists would follow her lead and do extraordinarily rigorous upfront work to decide who deserves support, and then give them support without strings, which is what she did with us. And it's been already catalytic, which I can talk more about if you'd like.
But fascinating. Tell me a little bit more about that Mackenzie Scott.
Well, the Mackenzie Scott gift, and I think any of the folks that have been fortunate enough, the organizations probably went through something similar, which is you can't, it's like Fort Knox. You can't get into her people, which I understand, or even her advisors at the Bridgeband Group. I mean, everybody sort of knows it, that she has advisors and that there's a process, but trying to sort of get in that line. So when I got an email out of nowhere, at first I thought, okay, it's a donor. I get a lot of those. But then when I saw, you know, Bridgeband, and her name was never mentioned in the process, but the process was extraordinarily rigorous. Anybody that thinks that she just throws money at organizations and doesn't do it without the strategy, I think, are not doing their homework on the process, because I've never in the 20 years been through something as rigorous as what we went through with them. We presented a strategic plan, years of financial information, you know, peer-reviewed data, and then we waited and we got a $15 million grant from her last March. And the amazing thing about it that I've just never seen, that again is so powerful, I hope an academic writes about it, is it came without strings. It came without any strings. I didn't have to sign anything that said we would spend it in a certain way. We would report quarterly back to some faceless group of bureaucrats. It was, you know how to spend this because you're the experts and we trust you to do that. Now that, again, sounds simple-minded, like you're just trusting people. But the thing that's amazing about it, and this is what I hope somebody will do some deep research, is that because we don't have to report to her on how we're using it, we're already iterating in terms of how we're spending it. I don't have to go back and say, well, we presented a strategic plan, but we're learning that maybe if we do this instead of this, we can move the needle on surgeries more dramatically. So to give you just some numbers of what that looks like in terms of real women, when we went into March of this year, before we had the money from her, our projection for the number of surgeries
in March 2023.
Yes, in 2023, was 12,400. And that was a 15% growth over the previous year. So it wasn't like we were running in place. That was already for us some significant growth. But I can tell you that we've closed out 2023 doing 14,000 surgeries. We moved the needle that dramatically because we had money that we could spend, that we didn't have to report back about exactly which countries we're going to put it in and what order. We could just pedal to the metal and use it quickly. And that surprised even me that we were able to use it that quickly. I joke that I've got my third Honda. I hate car problems and I love it when cars don't break down. I said to the team, I said, I thought we had a Honda. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a Lexus. It goes fast. It's not going to break down. It's really well built, but it also can move fast. And that, it's extraordinary to me. If we had had, for instance, a typical grant, even of that size, where it comes in chunks over a number of years, and every quarter you're reporting back of how you're doing it, I would have been spending time with the reporting. I would have been making decisions about, okay, do we do this because it's slightly different than what we said? And the nice thing about not having it attached to something specific is that we can make, again, smart, iterative decisions that come from decades of knowledge, not reporting back to people that only have a sort of generalized sense of what you are doing. It's just been amazing. And I really do hope that there'll be some academic work on this that will inform other philanthropists. So they say, gosh, you want to make a difference, you need to let go of some of the bureaucracy at these larger foundations where you've got middle people that you're reporting back to, don't know as much about it as you do, that are in some ways you're, you know, judge and jury on it. And
I mean, there is a drive towards trust-based philanthropy, although not everybody who claims to embrace trust-based philanthropy actually acts the way they claim that
she does.
She does. And so that must be an incredible vote of confidence, and not only heartening for your staff, but also reassuring for your existing donors, and arguably also an attraction for potential donors.
Yes, that is the hope. In fact, when we announced a gift publicly, we attached it to the strategic plan that we had shared with her advisors. And the only update was we put her gift in there, so that her gift was in essence a down payment on a larger plan. And that's partly to counter anybody that would say, oh, you've got, you know, $15 million, you don't need my $100. I mean, our average gift is under $100, or median gift is under $100. And, or if you're giving us $50,000, you still, either of those, a big gift or an average gift, you might look at $15 million and say, you don't need my $100, you don't need my $50,000. Actually, we need both and then some. So the plan was to say, you know, yes, this is a huge amount of money, but here's our plan of what we want to do. This is really a down payment on a bigger plan. The hope would be that this is a hope that other philanthropists, I mean, if I were a philanthropist, I would be looking, and if I had advisors, I would be looking at who she's funded, because there's a hack in there in a way, which is there's some research that's already been done. It doesn't mean that you only look at those organizations, but these organizations have gone through really thorough vetting. So to put them in a consideration set, that's certainly what I hope happens with us. But again, on the program side, the ability to use that money to basically we talked earlier about, the for-profit side of the world that, you're always looking at, basically shareholder value and how much you're returning on people's investment. What's the little or bottom line? Our bottom line is number of surgeries. That's what drives us. That's not that we funded hospitals, we fund outreach, we fund training, but the thing that drives us, the metric that we as an organization pay attention to, is the number of surgeries. And so to be able to see in 10 months that we could move the needle so quickly, because we're not running, this isn't obviously a widget factory where you just run it nights and weekends, you add an extra line. It isn't that, because it's hospitals and patients and doctors, and it's not as simple.
I was going to ask you about the logistics, right? Because you could have a huge bag of money, but maybe you don't have the doctors, or you don't have the hospitals, or you can't transport the patients.
That's exactly. Now, if somebody said, would it be possible for you to sort of double the N in a year? I would say only if I was able to rally like everybody in the world to help, because there's constraints, and you're smart to have noticed what they are, which is there are only a certain number of doctors that have this training, and the last thing a woman with fistula wants is an untrained doctor. Why? Because the body cavity you're operating on literally is there's not that much tissue in there, and the injury that we're addressing is our holes. Okay, so that isn't like a tear where you just sew it up. There's a lack of tissue, and you really need to know what you're doing, or you can create a permanent injury for a woman that another surgeon can't fix. So that's an important supply constraint. We work very closely with FIGO, which is a French acronym for the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics. And actually the person that runs the FIGO training program is on our board. And we work hand in glove with them, so to speak, on training surgeons. And they do an amazing job and have certainly increased the supply of fistula surgeons. But you don't train a surgeon over a weekend. It's competency-based training, and there's levels of expertise depending on severity of injury. So that is a supply constraint. That said, we've been partnering with FIGO now for over 10 years. So that supply chain of doctors has got a number of folks in it, but we can't double capacity in like a year. But I was surprised, because in essence, one of the interesting things, at least for us, the folks at Mackenzie Scott's organizations will allow you to not announce the gift or the amount of the gift, and that you can, if you want to, sort of slow the roll, if you will, in terms of how you get it. You could get it over a few years so that it sort of, your financials then look even, like we're going to have this huge spike. We thought about that, honestly, for about like, I don't know, a minute and a half, maybe it was longer than that. But no. I mean, why? Because if you're a woman and you have a hole in your vagina that's leaking waste, you wanted that thing fixed yesterday. You don't want to wait because we want our financials to look good. I was like, no, we're going to take this now. We're going to be honest with our donors, and then we're going to do what we can to get as many women treated. Again, efficiently. This isn't going to cost us more per patient. We're not going to throw money at this, but let's see what we can do if we take any of the constraints off, the supply constraints on money, and sort of spend this as quickly as we can. And my hope is that being able to demonstrate this will show other funders that this isn't just me hoping. We now have data to say lots of money can be translated into outcomes for some of the most destitute women that will transform their life in a short period of time. And honestly, I wasn't sure that we could do it that quickly. And that's deeply satisfying, but it's also motivating to try to get more funders in to help at the scale she's helped at.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, and delightful that you're here to tell us that story, because it's really heartening to hear. How did you get into all of this? I always ask my guests a little bit about that personal narrative, but tell me how you ended up where you are. I know you were at Berkeley a little while ago.
So Some dark nights of the soul. No, I spent my 20s. I went undergrad. I studied. I had no idea what I wanted. I wanted Mary Tyler Moore's life. She was a television character, and she had her own life. And somehow that appealed to me. And in my 20-year-old self. And so I worked in advertising during my 20s. And how I ended up there is just random luck. And it was interesting and fun. And I think it played to, I liked the creativity of it. And it took me a while to realize that I was, using whatever brain power I had with a bunch of really creative people to mostly, use brands to get people to spend more money than they should on whatever the product is, making them feel good about something. And it really didn't align with my values, but that light went on when I took a sabbatical, but I took a trip around the world at 27. I just took a break with a friend and we traveled through Europe and all the rest of it. But then we spent half the time in developing Asia. And 30 plus years ago, it was a lot poorer than it is now. And I never came all the way back from that trip. There's a part of my heart that's in Nepal and India and Indonesia. And so I left my advertising career, went back and studied international development because I'm sort of a practical person who wanted to be well prepared. So I left the advertising and that's it. And then I've had some, how I ended up at Fish Tale Foundation is also somewhat random, although I did visit the hospital, the one I mentioned a long time ago, in Africa, in Ethiopia in 1994. And that was also one of those, I didn't know it at the time. I walked out of that place and I had grad student debt and an old back to Honda and a 10-year-old Honda. And I was like, I wish I had money, I'd put it here. And as my missionary friends would say, the hand of God, I don't have money. I don't work at Google, but I basically raise money for this endeavor. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. So I feel very lucky. I'm like a very lucky person because this work, it means something to the deepest part of my being, and to get up every day and do work that you feel aligned with is what greater privileges are in life to have work that you care about.
I love it. What's that key takeaway you'd love for the audience to keep in mind after they finish listening to today's episode?
My key takeaway is that the challenge for the 21st century is to improve the lives, livelihoods of women and girls. We still live in a world where one gender has more access to resources than the other gender. And so the issue I work on is a symptom of that greater problem. So while things are definitely improving, they need to improve faster and more for the half of humanity that doesn't have the same opportunities as the other half of humanity. And sometimes places like London or Silicon Valley, it's easy to miss that because here things are much more equal. But that's not true in often the poorer the country, the greater the inequality, the more poverty affects women and girls more adversely than it does boys and men. So that's my takeaway. I think we live in a hopeful time. Things are definitely getting better, but they need to get better faster for women and girls.
Hear, hear. Kate, thank you so very much for joining us today on the Do One Better podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure hosting you on the show.
Thank you.
Perfect, and that's a wrap. Thanks very much for tuning in. As always, you've been listening to a great conversation with Kate Grant, Chief Executive of the Fistula Foundation. For information about this conversation and more than 250 other interviews with remarkable thought leaders in philanthropy, sustainability, and social entrepreneurship, just visit our website at lidji.org. That's lidji.org. Please click that subscribe button and follow us if you're not doing so already, and do leave us a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show as well. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you this coming Monday.